Runaway Country is brought to you by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. America's story has always been complicated and unfinished. The country began as a rebellion against monarchy and divine rule. And the founders tried to build something radically different, a secular government where power comes from the people and not religion. That idea became part of the Constitution itself. No religious tests, no state church, and freedom of conscience protected for everyone. Those principles were never perfectly realized, but they created a framework that allowed freedom and rights to expand over time. And now, as America celebrates its 250th anniversary, we are seeing growing debates about whether that separation between religion and government should continue to hold. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is working to protect the First Amendment because it protects all of us, regardless of belief. Visit ffrf.us/Alex or text my first name, A-L-E-X, to 511-511 to learn more and join. As we head toward America's 250th, this isn't just about history. It's about the future we choose next. So go to ffrf.us/Alex or text my name, Alex, to 511-511. Remember, text Alex to 511-511 today and support the work of protecting our shared freedoms. Message and data rates may apply. Hi, everyone. Months after the murders of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, this week a new chapter of ICE resistance began in the state of New Jersey.
Overnight protesters clashing with police. There were dozens of arrests for violating a curfew the mayor of Newark imposed outside the ICE detention center at Delaney Hall. Anywhere within a half mile is off limits from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., and police moved in to clear the streets.
That is ABC reporting on protests outside an ICE prison, where inside, detainees are waging a hunger strike over their living conditions. While camera phones have captured people being pulled from their cars or shot in the streets, they aren't there inside these prisons to record spoiled food and filthy latrines, deadly medical conditions left untreated, and retaliation against people who speak out. That is often the reality of what comes after an arrest for people swept up by ICE and sent to detention centers across the country. The horrific conditions and deplorable treatment are being documented by lawyers, and they're shared among families. But when it's not happening in public, it's hard to get America to pay attention. And the Trump administration is betting on just that.
And we believe that it should be shut down because we have actual irrefutable evidence now that the place is uninhabitable.
That is Newark Mayor Roz Baraka, who's suing the company that operates the Delaney Hall ICE jail. It's a private company called the GEO Group. If that name sounds familiar, President Trump just named a former GEO Group executive, David Venturella, as the new head of ICE. Border czar Tom Homan used to consult for the GEO Group as well. And former Attorney General Pam Bondi was a consultant for the company as recently as 2019. It seems like a revolving door of corruption. GEO Group keeps the detainee population growing, offers them the cheapest care possible, and fills its coffers in the meantime. That's why the company profits soared by 800% between 2024 and 2025. Over 60,000 people are being held in ICE detention centers across the country, ones just like Delaney Hall. And nearly 50 people have died in ICE custody since Donald Trump was reelected, an apparent consequence of the conditions inside these prisons. Last week, New Jersey Senator Andy Kim was pepper sprayed as he tried to de-escalate a standoff between protesters and ICE agents outside Delaney Hall. But this week, Senate Republicans aim to give even more money to ICE in order to seize even more undocumented migrants and pay companies like the GEO Group a very handsome profit to house them in shameful, oftentimes deplorable conditions. As of this recording, Senate Republicans are expected to vote Wednesday evening to dump over $70 billion into the laps of immigration enforcement agencies. That is all in addition to the funding ICE already has on hand, $85 billion. But don't expect Republicans or the Trump administration to attach any strings to this money or any reform, something Democrats have been demanding since the murders of Alex Preddy and Renee Nicole Good. Here's DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen responding on Tuesday to questions about the inhumane conditions at Delaney Hall.
We have today, I believe, under 700 detainees there. It's licensed for just over 1,000 beds. We have twice the square footage at Delaney Hall than the state penitentiary does in New Jersey. They said that the medical condition was horrible. We have twice as much medical staff per person than the state penitentiary does in New Jersey.
Whatever Trump and his party are alleging, the fight is clearly not over. The people stuck in prisons like Delaney Hall in New Jersey, Adelanto Detention Facility in California, Northlake Processing Center in Michigan, and Moshannon Valley Processing Center in Pennsylvania are protesting in one of the only ways they can, hunger strikes. Here's the BBC's coverage of what's happening inside Delaney Hall.
Because ever since detainees in there went on a hunger and labor strike reporting inhumane conditions, well, not only protesters, but state lawmakers have come down here demanding that the detention facility be closed ultimately, but also let state officials in to fully inspect the conditions there.
As conservatives try to flood ICE with even more money to do more of this, what happens to the people in ICE custody? Because the terror around immigration enforcement is still very much outside. It's just not outside. I'm Alex Wagner, and this week on Runaway Country, as Republicans prepare to give ICE a budget the size of a small country's economy, what is happening to citizens and non-citizens alike behind the closed doors of detention facilities? We're going to be talking to one of the best reporters in the country on this topic, Pulitzer Prize winner Caitlin Dickerson, who writes about immigration for The Atlantic. How has ICE's strategy changed? What parts of the deportation process aren't being talked enough about? And what can any of us do about any of this?
I went to Honduras to the airport where deportees, every deportee from the United States to Honduras arrives. And I spent a week there embedded and I talked to people essentially as they were getting off the plane from the United States. And sure enough, more than half of the people that I interviewed said that they had left children behind.
But first, since we can't talk to the people in detention, we wanted to get as close as possible to a firsthand perspective of life inside one of these detention centers. So I'm talking to Melissa Shepherd, a removal defense attorney at Immigration Defenders Law Center, IMDEF. Here is our conversation. Melissa, thanks for joining Runaway Country and giving us perspective on a part of our democracy that is definitely not discussed enough. Just first, what is life like inside detention centers right now?
Yeah, that's a really, really important question. You know, things are tough inside of these detention centers. We are regularly visiting our clients weekly, and we are hearing directly from them about what life is like on a daily basis, you know. One of their main concerns is basic necessities. They are having serious issues with even getting clean drinking water.
Really?
With the water in particular, they have kind of like a jug that is something that everyone is able to share. Within these clear jugs, they are able to physically see sticks and dirt floating around. The water comes out brown or yellow. So once that jug of water is finished and, you know, essentially they realize that it needs to be replaced, it can take up to 8 hours for them to receive a new jug of water. So they're not asking for a lot, right? Like the detainees are asking for really basic necessities that any one of us need to continue to survive. Beyond the water, the food that they receive is often spoiled. The meat that they eat is undercooked. The portions tend to be pretty small. So especially for men who are burning a lot of calories throughout the day, they're just not receiving enough food. And so in turn, they're having to have to go to commissary to purchase food to supplement, you know, the already rotten and moldy food that they're being served.
To go back to the water for a second, they're sharing jugs of water in areas of the detention center. Like multiple people are sharing these jugs of water, and that's what they have
effectively for the day. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, correct. So in each one of their units, they'll have this large kind of jug of water that they can serve themselves water throughout the day. And what we've heard also is they're not even provided with cups. So what they are doing is their empty bottles that they had purchased from commissary, they're able to refill that and use that to continue to get water. And most of the time, you know, the water is subpar quality.
It's dirty. It has objects floating in it. And I'm assuming you're talking mostly about adults that you're representing and that you're working with. But I would wonder what it's like for children in similar detention centers across the country. One of the things that keeps coming up and that we've seen as a real point of concern at the Delaney Detention Center, where a lot of people have been focused in the last week because Senator Andy Kim was pepper sprayed outside the detention facility. It's been controversial since the beginning of its inception, if you will, is the issue of medical care. Can you talk to me about what kind of medical services are provided for people inside detention, many of whom, as I understand it, were detained without their medications? They were just kind of snatched, taken away, put into detention. And so one would assume that they need medical care, if not prescriptions.
They are provided with some level of medical care in these facilities. However, in sharing that, the medical services that they receive are really absolutely awful. I mean, we are regularly seeing patterns of medical neglect, delayed medical care. Like you said, people are going in there with pre-existing issues, so there's interruptions in access to medication. Once they're actually there, the medical requests are often ignored. The neglect that they're experiencing is truly profound. You know, we just talked to somebody yesterday, one of MDEF's clients, who has been asking to see a doctor for over a month for a hangnail that has just gotten worse and has reached the point of infection. So we are constantly seeing medical issues that maybe if there was some type of early intervention, they could be stopped at that point. However, the neglect has just continued on. And I can give you one example of a recent person that we spoke with who suffers from epilepsy. He is on a regimented routine of when he should be taking his medications, but the detention center decides when it's convenient for them to distribute medications. So he was not receiving his medications in a timely manner, suffered a seizure, fell on the floor, hit his head, had a huge gash, and needed stitches from that. And once he saw a doctor afterwards, after this seizure, the doctor said, yeah, the fact that you didn't receive your medication on this regimented schedule is probably the reason that you suffered this seizure.
Wow. I mean, you hear that and it gives you real perspective on the fact that I think this year, 18 people have died in detention across the country since the start of the Trump administration. 48 people have died in detention. Do you think, I mean, I'm not asking you to say definitively, but I would assume if you're not getting your medications on time, if small problems balloon into larger problems, things like a hangnail balloons into something that could become sepsis, like, does that help explain the mortality rate inside detentions? What are you hearing?
There's no doubt that because of the neglect that folks are experiencing while detained, it is causing them to lose their lives. Detainees are expressing to us constantly that being there is a death sentence. You know, we have people who have diabetes, who maybe are on regular dialysis and are not getting the treatment that they need. And we are seeing it being exacerbated in unimaginable ways. There was a woman that we represented who had a pre-existing eye condition, and because of the lack of medical treatment that she received, she ended up losing her eyesight completely.
Wow.
So these are absolutely preventable, but, you know, it's very obvious to us that these are intentional tactics used by this administration to deter people from remaining in the U.S. and fighting for their cases.
Yeah, it's a mechanism to force self-deportation. What are they legally entitled to in terms of medical care?
They're supposed to be able to see a medical doctor. And I think a lot of these facilities get away with being able to give people the bare minimum. So sometimes, you know, somebody will make a request to go see a doctor after many attempts, you know, they're finally able to see somebody and they might get something like Tylenol or ibuprofen to treat a much more severe issue. So, you know, I think once they're even able to speak with any type of medical care staff, the level of care is truly substandard.
We're going to get into who's actually running these prisons in a second, but are there doctors on site at the facility? I would assume there are.
There are, you know, and they sometimes the medical staff isn't necessarily staffed there, but they'll go visit the facility. Sometimes if it is a pretty extreme medical condition, they will send them to a local hospital. And, you know, I think that's a whole nother can of worms where if our client ends up going to one of these hospitals, they are taken off the ICE detainee locator. They will not tell their attorneys which hospital they're located in. So they essentially go into a legal black hole and we're not able to talk to them and counsel them and advise them.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, you can understand the desperation. First of all, you know, we, of course, wanted to speak to a detainee. That's an impossibility. Sometimes family members and lawyers can't track down detainees. There's so little information coming out of these detention centers. It gives you real context into the hunger strikes that are happening. I mean, we talked about the Delaney Detention Center in New Jersey. That's where there's a pretty high profile a hunger strike apparently underway, although the federal government is denying that. There's also a hunger strike, correct me if I'm wrong, at the Adelanto Detention Center, which is 2 hours northeast of Los Angeles. Can you give us any information on that and what started it?
I believe that it started around May 22nd. So we're, you know, running into a little over a week here at this point. But what started it is basically the detainees got together and said, we are fed up with being treated as subhuman, where we are not even given the basic necessities that we need to survive. And in fact, for many of them, their health conditions are worsening while in the detention center. So it was a coordinated effort, and our understanding is it started with approximately 20 individuals. As of yesterday, we talked to one of our clients who is participating in the hunger strike, and he said that it has risen to about 120 individuals. And they are just protesting these unlivable conditions, anywhere from the food and water that we discussed to basic sanitary conditions. They don't have regular janitorial services in there. And so the individuals who are detained in these facilities are taking turns amongst the other people who are in their area as to who's on duty to clean any particular day. Wow. Because they don't want to sit there in their own filth.
Wow. More of my conversation with Melissa Shepherd right after a quick break. Runaway Country is brought to you by Ethos. If you are a responsible parent or just a responsible person, you are probably thinking about the span of life, your span of life, and you may be thinking about life insurance. I know that at some point I buckled up, put on my big parent pants, and was like, I gotta sort this out for my kids. And that is why I and my partner looked into life insurance and got some. Because we want to make sure that those kids are A-OK no matter what life has in store for us. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, 100% online. You can get a quote in seconds, you can apply in minutes, and you can get same-day coverage. There is no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions. You can get up to $3 million in coverage. Some policies are as low as $30 a month. So take 10 minutes to get covered today with life insurance through Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Alex. That is ethos.com/Alex. Application times may vary and rates may vary. Runaway Country is brought to you by Miracle Made. Here is a disgusting fact. I know you want one. Traditional bed sheets can hold more bacteria than a toilet seat. Yeah, not exactly what you want to lay your face on. Miracle Made bedding is designed to fight bacteria and stay cleaner longer with silver-infused fabrics that actually prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. That means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, and way less laundry. All that hidden bacteria in your regular sheets, well, it can clog your pores and cause breakouts. Miracle Made's antibacterial design helps you sleep cleaner and clearer night after night. They feel just as good, if not better, than sheets you'd find at a five-star hotel, but without the steep price tag. Smooth, breathable, and ridiculously comfortable. So upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/Alex to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use promo code Alex, A-L-E-X, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free three-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there is no risk. That's trymiracle.com/Alex, code A-L-E-X at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. We've heard reports that in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, detention facilities are effectively cutting communication lines during hunger strikes or as soon after they start so that people can't be in touch with their lawyers or family members. Have you heard about that? And is that legal?
No, it's definitely not legal. I think this is something that we continue to see with under this administration. They're doing a lot of illegal acts to really impede due process. But that is something that we've heard for the Adelanto facility in particular. At least the day the hunger strike started, phone lines were cut and nobody was able to make any outgoing calls. And obviously it's a concern. People, in addition to being detained in these facilities, people have their legal cases going on. We need to be able to access our clients, prepare them for their hearings. So these types of retaliation measures are unfortunately very common. Our understanding is at least one person who was part of the hunger strike in Adelanto was put into solitary confinement as a form of retaliation. So they're definitely, the officers there are definitely keeping an eye on who's participating and trying to intimidate them into giving up.
Are the hunger strikes giving them leverage?
I don't know that it's necessarily giving them leverage, but I think it's putting a lot of pressure on those people who are running the facility. We understand that they are trying to get people to eat by any means necessary by bringing them actually good, delicious, nutritious food that they've been denied all these months. But I do know, you know, as one other form of retaliation, some of our clients have let us know that they saw the news that there are hunger strikes happening across the U.S. They saw it on the TV. And when the officers noticed that that is what was being portrayed on the news, they cut off the TV. But I will say seeing solidarity across the country and other detention centers has given them more joy and unity to keep going and fighting for what they know is right.
The other piece of this that seems to be really taxing for the detainees is the pace at which their cases are being processed and heard. I mean, at the start, when this podcast first started, one of our first episodes was with an immigration judge who had just been fired, part of a systematic hollowing out of the judiciary meant to hear these cases and hear them in a thoughtful or at least expeditious manner. And, you know, she was just talking about the extraordinary backlog that existed back then, right? And it seems like, and Senator Kim was one of the people that sort of brought this, I think, national focus on it, was just the pace, the extraordinary delays people face in detention getting their cases heard. What is the process like at this point, as far as you understand it?
Yeah, I think you're right. We're regularly talking to folks who have not had a hearing in months. And especially for somebody who has never had any type of criminal interaction, which is many of these detainees.
Is it, it's the vast majority, isn't it? I mean, I think somewhere I read something like 68 to 70% of the people inside have no record.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And so going from somebody who has had no interaction with, you know, any type of criminal justice system to going to literally being put in an ICE prison is absolutely jarring. But you're right, there are delays. And I think, unfortunately, one tactic that this administration has used to try and deal with the backlog has been to pre-termit cases, essentially say, well, I don't think that you're going to have a good chance of winning, so let's go ahead and close out this case. So people are not even able to get to the point where they're able to fight their case in court. Interesting that you mentioned the immigration judge, but it's very obvious that the immigration judges still on the bench are under a lot of pressure to not grant cases or grant really high bonds. We had two clients last week who have no criminal history whatsoever, have lived in the U.S. for decades, have children, you know, have lived their entire lives here, and they were given a $20,000 bond.
Wow. I can't even imagine, like, you make such an important point, which is these are people who may not have their paperwork to be American citizens or their green cards, but they have been living life as Americans without crime for decades. They have CVS pharmacy prescriptions that they pick up. They have cell phones that they use to call their people with. They, you know, they're living life like everybody else. And one day, all of a sudden, that life is snatched away from them and they're not sent to anything that resembles this country. I mean, it just sounds so extraordinarily appalling. It's amazing and it's staggering to think that this is being done in our name to thousands and thousands of innocent people, which brings me to my question, like, who's running all of this? Geo Group, right? This is a private company, Geo Group, that's G-E-O for anybody who's going to Google it, that's been running a lot of the largest detention centers in the country, right, Melissa? It's is it a coincidence that all of the hunger strikes being carried out by detainees right now are at Geo Group run detention facilities, ICE prisons?
Yeah, it's absolutely not a coincidence. I mean, these facilities know what they're doing. They are working very closely with ICE to make conditions as deplorable as possible so that people give up on their cases. Geo's purpose is to, they're a for-profit prison company. They have billions of dollars in revenue. It is in their interest to keep as many people incarcerated as long as possible. We've talked about the delays with their immigration cases. Sometimes we hear from people who have said, I asked to be removed to, you know, whatever country it is. And there they are 2 months later, still unable to leave the United States, even though that's what they've asked for.
Why is that? Why would you be denied just because Geo Group wants to keep them as a money-making detainee in one of their prison systems?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the inefficiencies of coordinating deportation flights. You know, they expanded the number of people being detained in this facility exponentially. I think the Adelanto facility in particular had gotten down to less than a handful of detainees. And we're pretty much at max capacity now, you know, with almost 2,000 people in that facility.
Yeah, I think I read that it was like 13 people inside the system and now it's 2,000. Along with those, just the extraordinary uptick in numbers is an extraordinary uptick in profit for Geo Group. In 2024, the company made $32 million and they've made in 2025 over $250 million. The for-profit nature of all of this seems incredibly ethically compromised. And it also suggests that not only does Geo Group benefit from having people languish in its prisons, it benefits from giving them the cheapest care possible. And I mean care because these people's lives are in their hands. So that, do you think that explains why they're underfed, drinking dirty water, not seeing doctors, and otherwise, you know, having their spiritual legs cut from beneath them as they sit in these ICE prisons?
Yeah, I mean, it's very obvious that it's in Geo's best interest to provide the very minimum care that they can for people who are being detained there. You know, they can say, we're giving you water. They're also not going to talk about the fact that this is literally dirty water. The containers that are holding the water have mold growing on them. So I think they're able to get away with saying, we're providing the basic standard things that anybody needs to survive. But in reality, this is continuing to cause additional health and mental health problems for people who are being detained in these types of conditions.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's worth noting when you talk about GEO Group and their incentive structure here. President Trump has appointed, I think his name is David Venturella, who's a former executive at the GEO Group, to replace Todd Lyons as the head of ICE. Tom Homan, I believe, the border czar, worked at the GEO Group as well. It's a staging ground for Trump administration officials dealing with immigration. Well, let me just ask you, Melissa, you know, you give me this insanely bleak picture of what's happening. What is the emotional tenor of the conversations you've been having? I mean, it's helpful to know that when folks inside these ICE prisons see hunger strikes or forms of protest blossoming around the country, it's a sense of solidarity and perhaps even a source of hope. But what can you tell me about the sort of emotional aspect of all of this?
You're right. It's really difficult when we talk to our clients who've been detained there for months. You know, maybe they were the breadwinner of their family and they're leaving behind their pregnant partner and a couple of U.S. citizen children. You know, and they had a business in the U.S. and were paying taxes. It's life altering, not only for the people who are detained, but also for their family on the outside who has to completely rethink how they're going to function without one very important member of their family. So I know that emotional toll of being torn apart from their family is really difficult. Many of these people came to the United States seeking safety and have said, being here, I at least know I'm in the United States. If I go back to my home country, I will be killed. Wow. So they'd rather take their chances of these absolutely horrible conditions rather than going back to certain death. So, I mean, I think that is when you know that people are here truly trying to seek safety and they're not just here to try and take advantage of the system as, you know, this administration has painted.
Yeah, they've made that test incredibly grueling. But man, to still believe in the goodness of this country and to want to stay here tells you about their, you know, who they are as people and citizens of our democracy, if not actually with the paperwork. Melissa Shepherd from Immigration Defenders Law Center. It is really eye-opening to get this perspective. I'm really grateful for, first of all the work that you're doing. And for the information and you know, the stories that you're able to share with us. So thanks for joining the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. Thank you for just highlighting and humanizing our clients and the very real people who are stuck in this you know, system. It's absolutely important to keep remembering that these are real people.
Yeah, this is ongoing. This is an ongoing situation that Republicans in Congress would like to throw billions of dollars more money at. Thank you, Melissa. Good luck out there.
Thank you, Alex.
After the break, we will put all of this into context with The Atlantic's immigration reporter, Caitlin Dickerson. Runaway Country is brought to you by OneSkin. Whether you're someone who tries every new skincare product that hits the market or you've been using the same one or two things for years, at some point, most of us realize our skin isn't just keeping up the way it used to. And that is what OneSkin changed for me. It didn't just make my existing routine better. It actually works differently than anything else I've tried, and I have been using it for a month now. As we age, some skin cells stop functioning the way they should. Longevity scientists call them zombie cells. And that's what's actually driving those visible signs of aging, the fine lines, the loss of firmness, the dullness that creeps in over time. And OneSkin's OS1 peptide was specifically engineered to address those. So you're getting everything you expect from great skincare with OS1 doing something most skincare was never built to do. I have been using their moisturizer. I love the feel of it. I love its absorption. I love the weight of it. And over time, I am really hoping that it helps me with the aging process. You do not need a complicated routine to get healthier, younger-looking skin. Born from over a decade of longevity research, OneSkin's OS1 peptide is proven to target the visible signs of aging, helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using code Alex at oneskin.co/Alex. That is 15% off oneskin.co with code Alex. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support Runaway Country and tell them we sent you. Runaway Country is brought to you by ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. I'd love to tell you I'm one of those ladies that can have 3 glasses of wine and still wake up glowing, but boy, I am not. Somewhere in my late 20s, which was just a few moments ago, the morning after a few drinks started to hit it, shall we say, differently. That is why I started drinking ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It is a buildup of this byproduct and not dehydration that is to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you will feel your best tomorrow. I really do notice a difference every single time I have pre-alcohol before drinks. And this week I forgot to bring my ZBiotics with me, and it's been tough, people. Even after a night out with ZBiotics, I can confidently plan on maybe exercising, doing really articulate podcasting, being a fantastic parent without worry. Between weddings and the first real beach weekend of the year, June barely leaves a Saturday open, so don't let a rough morning after cost you your Sunday. Drink pre-alcohol to stay ahead of it and make the most of every weekend this month. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/Alex and use the code Alex at checkout for 15% off. Caitlin, when we wanted to tackle this topic, I thought we got to get Caitlin Dickerson because your reporting on this has been so essential. So thank you for joining the podcast.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
I want to start with what's happening in Washington. It's a fluid situation always when Republicans are running the government, but they are supposed to vote. I believe it is tonight. Again, I'm time stamping this. It's Wednesday afternoon on the East Coast. But they're supposed to vote on a reconciliation bill that will give ICE another ICE and Customs and Border Patrol another $72 billion. Given how well-funded their efforts already are, what do you think that practically means for those agencies to just be awash in money?
I think it means a lot of deportations, a lot of detentions, a continued expansion of the detention system that we have, and, you know, a furtherance of President Trump's promise that he campaigned on of mass deportation. So, yes, there have been shakeups. Yes, the ICE activity in the streets slowed down, certainly after what happened in January in Minnesota when 2 American citizen protesters were killed. But the detentions and deportations continue. And even despite the shakeups, you know, Secretary Kristi Noem losing her job, being replaced by Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, the messaging out of DHS and out of Tom Homan, who is sort of the de facto head of this whole operation, has been clear that mass deportations continue. Homan has even said things that suggest that we really haven't seen what mass deportations even look like yet, that they're going to be even more aggressive. And so this funding certainly allows for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the posture, there may not be as many expensive horse rental bills as there were under Secretary Noem, but the posture of the administration remains incredibly antagonistic, pugilistic. Even Mark Wayne Mullen, the Homeland Security Secretary, said this on Fox last week.
We're currently drawing up plans to say, listen, in these sanctuary cities where the local radical left Democrats aren't allowing us to do our job and enforce federal laws, then we shouldn't be processing international flights into their cities either, because they don't want us to enforce immigration, but they want us to process immigration at their facilities. Nothing about that makes sense to me.
Okay, that is the scene of protests outside of Delaney Hall in New Jersey, in Newark, which is, of course, home to Newark Airport. I think the suggestion from the Homeland Security Secretary is they are no longer going to process flights coming into Newark because of protests related to a hunger strike that is happening inside Delaney Hall, which the federal government denies, and that customs agents are going to stop processing arrivals into Newark Airport, which is like, I don't know, is it the dictionary definition of cutting off your nose to spite your face? Like, that's a huge airport in the United States. I'm sure there are lots of Republicans that use it. Also, really, this is the comeuppance. First, let me get your thoughts on Mullen's suggestion here that this is the retaliatory strike, and then talk to me about what you think of him as DHS secretary.
So my colleague Nick Miroff at The Atlantic did a great story about this plan to cut off international flight processing in sanctuary cities as a way to retaliate or pressure those cities into being less obstructive or to go along with the deportation campaign. And it really doesn't make any sense. You alluded to that. You know, cutting off international flights to cities really doesn't hurt the city. It hurts the airlines. People can still get where they want to go. You know, travelers who want to come to New York City, for example, they're going to get here, whether they fly into Newark, JFK, LaGuardia, or Baltimore, and then drive. You know, it's not really going to directly impact. It doesn't seem, at least, anything like tourism or local economies. What it does is just create more chaos and frustration for travelers who, as you pointed out, are Republicans and Democrats who are already facing much higher prices when they're buying their airline tickets because of the price of fuel, because of the war in Iran. And so it doesn't seem like it will be a successful strategy in any way, but I think it reflects that this administration is really grabbing at straws here, trying to find ways to force cities and states that oppose these mass deportations to go along with them. And this is something that Trump has been doing since the first time he was president and started attempting strategies to go after sanctuary cities. I mean, you see this again and again in his immigration enforcement policies, again, across now two administrations, this kind of throwing spaghetti to the wall to see what sticks effort. And that involves, I think, knowingly on the part of the Trump administration, lots of efforts that they know are going to get tied up in court, that they know aren't ultimately going to stand up legally, but that they hope will over time chip away at their goals. And so I think, you know, Senator Mullen sort of subbed in here for Kristi Noem as secretary. Obviously, she brought her own unique flair to the job, but this DHS secretary job is, it's somebody who's doing the White House's bidding, who's doing President Trump's bidding and Stephen Miller, his chief advisor on immigration's bidding. And, you know, they chose someone who they thought would be a good soldier and go along with what the directives from the White House are. And I think that's very much what we're seeing in Senator Mullen.
Yeah, and replete with terrible, terrible ideas and execution, much like Kristi Noem. I mean, speaking of terrible and insanely stupid ideas, sorry, I'm going to editorialize here, but the move to require green card applicants to apply from their home countries seems pretty catastrophic. Can you offer your thoughts on the practical realities of changing American policy on green card holders like that?
Yeah, and you know, it seems like the White House is already backing away from at least what they initially announced that policy would look like. But I think my takeaway from that announcement is that, you know, this whole period of time, you know, President Trump's campaign promised to go after people who were illegal lawbreakers. It's predicated on the idea that if you follow the rules, that you can stay, and that we're not deporting people out of animus, we're not deporting people out of, you know, hatred for immigrants, but we're deporting people because we want to restore the rule of law. This is what the administration says. And really encourage people by force to only enter the United States if they do things the right way. We know there are a lot of things that are wrong with that narrative that don't make sense. For most people who want to come to the United States, there is no right way. But I think at the same time that the messaging, that you know, the messaging is what I just described, you see this administration eliminating ways to legalize, legal processes to gain status, either temporary or permanent, and then turning around and saying, oh, you're illegal, and so you have to leave. So that includes getting rid of TPS for certain countries, temporary protected status. That includes, you know, going after DACA, which is this longtime effort that Trump has been engaged in to take away another form of temporary status. And now it's an effort that's targeting one of the only ways, frankly, that people who are in the United States without status to legalize at all. And I think the initiative, if it moves forward, even in a more limited way, I think will really help the public understand the reality of what's happening. I mean, I think it'll be devastating for families, absolutely, and result in far more family separations than we're even seeing now. And there are many. But I can't tell you how often I now am getting emails and DMs from readers who say, you know, Caitlin, you're writing about this person who's been in the United States for 10 years or 15 years. Why didn't they just take the time to legalize? Why didn't they do it the right way? And I really have to, you know, explain to people that there often is no right way. And so this policy to make green card applicants leave the country is an example of the administration taking away one of these major avenues that exists. And so, you know, it's really putting people in an impossible situation if you tell them you can only stay here legally, but we're going to eliminate all the ways for you to stay here legally.
Yeah. I mean, well, and you talk about family separations. You've done really great reporting on this. And I really think that when we talk about the immigration crisis here in the United States, and I say that from this sort of human rights point of view, not the idea that we're being flooded by brown people. But when you talk about the crisis and the emotional and the sort of the trauma and the moral stain that will be left on the country, the reality is that family separations continue. They're just happening on the other side of the border, right? Before, people were coming to the country having their children ripped away from them. Now, at the border and border processing, now they are being deported from the country without their children in many cases. Their children are left in who knows whose hands. Can you talk to me a little bit about what you have seen in your reporting and the experience of parents who don't have their papers, and even maybe sometimes those that do, as they're detained and deported outside of the U.S.?
Like you mentioned, by and large now, people who are being removed from the United States, deported, they've been living here. And many have been living here for years or decades, have homes, have families. And so it's a very different thing to separate a person like that from their family and their livelihood. It creates logistical challenges. Obviously, it creates emotional challenges and bureaucratic and diplomatic challenges. It's a big mess. And so, you know, the administration has said we're not separating families. That's sort of their official line. And that obviously goes against research that's been done. Most recently, Brookings came out with a report estimating that the parents of more than 200,000 children living in the United States have been detained, and that most of those parents have been deported. The numbers are just huge. And so I wanted to try to verify that with real examples, but, you know, also just kind of help give a shape to it, because we can look at the data, but who are these people and how are their families being affected? How are their children being affected? So I went to Honduras, to the airport where every deportee from the United States to Honduras arrives. And I spent a week there embedded, and I talked to people essentially as they were getting off the plane from the United States. And sure enough, more than half of the people that I interviewed said that they had left children behind. And I should say the percentage probably would have been higher if I focused on people who were, you know, ages 20 to 40, but I didn't. I also interviewed teenagers. I interviewed elderly people. So obviously this isn't a statistical sample, but it was very, very easy, frankly, to find people who'd been forced to leave children behind and who talked about ICE policy being violated again and again. So ICE has a policy that requires officers to ask actually anybody who's in their custody at each encounter, are you the parent of a minor child? And to confirm whether a parent wants to either be reunited with their child prior to deportation or to designate a guardian. And if so, do so in a sworn statement or a written statement. Most of the parents I talked to said they were never asked if they had children at all. And I interviewed several parents who said that they begged for help, either reuniting with their child or just being able to make legal arrangements, because lots of these children left behind are living in homes with neighbors, with extended relatives, volunteers, people from church who don't have the legal authority to take them to get medical care, to enroll them in school or counseling or any other services they may need, especially since they don't now have a parent there to pay for their basic needs. And so parents were begging for help, trying from ICE officers to make these arrangements in advance of being deported. I had one mom who told me that, you know, she left her three-year-old behind and an ICE officer said to her it didn't matter. And in fact, didn't even note on her paperwork that she was a parent at all.
Wow. I mean, this goes to whether that's just focused cruelty or terrible training or both. But the idea that three-year-olds are being left behind, they're just collateral damage for a disorganized and inhumane system is just, again, we talk about the family separations policy as if it's in the past, but it's ongoing. You know, I talked to, in my reporting, talking to these undocumented parents who said, you know, some of them had a plan for what would happen if mom or dad didn't come home, but it was almost unthinkable, right? Like your mom would go off to work and you might never see her again. And who are you going to call if and when that happened? And this is happening to the tune of 200,000 families, potentially. I mean, I also remember in Family Separation 1.0, there were no resources to try and help. I mean, it was completely ad hoc in terms of the groups that existed to both intake and help reunite these families. And I'm wondering, you know, being given that you were in Honduras and you talked to people who were dealing with these deportees as they arrived in a country that maybe wasn't even their own, what resources exist?
Very, very few. In some cases, none, Alex. I mean, there are some aid groups in the United States. KIND is one of them.
That's Kids in Need of Defense.
Thank you. Yes. There are a handful of groups in the United States that are working to try to help these families, but there is no government that's taken responsibility for them. And there's no formal process for families to try to reunite with one another. I mean, I think the one thing that so to speak, obviously, because we're talking about a devastating situation regardless, so to speak, the families that were separated during the first Trump administration, what they may have had going for them is that they, both the children and the parents, for the most part, were in U.S. government custody.
Right.
So the U.S. government had some responsibility to do something with them, except for the hundreds of parents that ended up just being deported without their children. Now we're talking about children in the United States, many of whom are United States citizens, so they're not in removal proceedings. They can't be deported. And then parents who've been dropped off in another country. And the United States has really washed its hands of responsibility for them once they land there. And so you can see how even just from a diplomatic vantage point, it's not clear who's in charge or who has any responsibility to get involved. And the hurdles that these families face for getting their children back are just massive because the children have mixed nationalities. Some are American, like I said. Some are from the country where the parent is currently. Some were born when families were on their migration route. I can't tell you how many families I've met who spent years on the move and often tried to resettle in other countries closer to their home country before they reached the United States, weren't able to find stability or safety or, you know, an economic way to live. And so they kept going. And so you might have a child who was born in a third country and
wow,
trying to get travel documents and legal authorization to move that child across borders from your home country that you presumably fled for a very specific reason, whether it was economic strain or your safety or what have you. It's an impossible maze to really try to confront.
I mean, and I assume the record keeping in and around where these parents even have been deported to is as abysmal as it was in Family Separations 1.0, when it was just kind of like, we don't know where anybody is. Good luck.
Yeah, I think the gap in records that's most striking this time around is just that lack of documentation around whether people detained are the parent of a minor child. So DHS has reported some numbers, but they seem to be, when compared with records that have been reviewed by academics at Brookings and other places, the University of Washington independently, there's no alignment that DHS seems to be really significantly undercounting the number of parents that it's detained and deported. And that's no surprise to me, given the interviews that I mentioned to you where parents said, you know, nobody asked me if I had a child. So there's no documentation of these separations at all.
More of my conversation with Caitlin in just a moment. But first, do not forget, tickets to CrookedCon 2026 are on sale and they are moving fast, friends. CrookedCon comes just days after the 2026 midterms, which means we'll maybe commiserate or maybe celebrate. But either way, we're going to have a lot to unpack and learn from as we head into 2028. CrookedCon starts on Thursday, November 5th with Pod Save America Live. Then on Friday night, November 6th, come see Strict Scrutiny or Love It or Leave It Live. Finally, on Saturday, November 7th, join us for a full day of CrookedCon panels and meetups. Expect presidential candidates, campaign strategists, pollsters, organizers, and me, yours truly. None of the above. Head to CrookedCon.com to get tickets or become a Friends of the Pod subscriber for a special discount. See you there. Runaway Country is brought to you by Mosh. The old adage, you are what you eat, rings very true to all of us in the modern day, and I'm always looking for an on-the-go protein snack that satisfies me, and now I have found one that helps me live intentionally as well, Mosh Protein Bars. Mosh Protein Bars are made with ingredients that support your brain and body, like ashwagandha, lion's mane, and omega-3s. Plus, Mosh is the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizin, a premium form of citicoline that helps support focus, memory, and mental clarity. And they taste really good. There are 9 delicious flavors, including plant-based options in chocolate chip cookie, hazelnut chocolate chip, and peanut chocolate chip. Just saying those words makes me hungry. It's more than just a protein bar. It's brain fuel with purpose. Every single time I find one of these bars in the bottom of my bag, I'm like, bingo zingo, I'm good for the next several hours. I truly feel like they help make me feel fueled up and are helping my brain at the same time. It's a win-win. So find your favorites, build your boxes, or keep things fresh with a variety pack. Mosh bars are the best way to customize your health while giving back. Head to moshlife.com/runaway and subscribe today to get 25% off your first variety pack and 20% off your monthly subscription with code RUNAWAY. That is 25% off your first pack and 20% off your subscription of brain-boosting bars delivered straight to your door. Start building brain health into your everyday with Mosh Bars. Thanks to Mosh for sponsoring this episode. So you have these deportees who, if their parents have been separated from their families in many cases, have no idea when they're going to see them again, have maybe no contact with their legal representatives because they've been shuttled around detention centers and have not really had strong communication lines, which is a euphemism. You reported that as of April, ICE is holding 60,000 people in custody. And those are the, you know, those are the people that in many cases are landing on Honduras where you were doing on the ground reporting. They don't have homes in Honduras, they don't have families in Honduras. They are facing in many cases the threats of gang violence or other incredibly perilous situations on the ground. There are some, you know, the Washington Post has reported on deportees who are being sent back to countries like Togo where they fled human rights violations, like genital mutilation. You know, people return to these countries, and return is probably the wrong word. They are abducted from the United States and sent to these countries. And not only is it emotionally traumatizing, economically devastating, but it's incredibly dangerous. Is it just church-run groups that are on the ground as people kind of come into these societies that they have no real place in that could be dangerous for them to re-enter?
Yeah, so it varies country to country. In Honduras, where I was reporting, the primary group on the ground is Scalabrinian nuns. And so there's a Scalabrinian nun who runs as a civil employee of the Honduran government, the reception center where deportees arrive, but she also lives on a small compound. It's about 10 minutes from the airport that has a shelter for deportees who have nowhere to go. And there are many of them because, as we've discussed, many have not been to Honduras for many years or decades, don't have anybody there to take them in. And just to give you a sense of the security situation people are returning to, that head nun who I interviewed just days before I arrived in San Pedro Sula, she herself was tied up and robbed at knife point in this property where the shelter exists, because the landscape in Honduras right now, it remains the gang-ridden country that it has been and that has led so many people to flee to the United States in the first place. So the country is really divided. It's sort of a patchwork of territories of that are controlled by competing gangs. And so, you know, I heard from the nuns that they've had several deportees killed within days of their arrival to Honduras. And lots of the people that I interviewed were grappling with that, who said they'd left children in the United States, that they, of course, wanted to be reunited with their children, but they left Honduras because they feared for their lives in the first place. And those same risks still exist. You know, people who had active and very specific threats and were showing me evidence of those threats, they're in an impossible circumstance right now, because the question is, do they reunite with their child, who they desperately want to be with, or do they leave their child and, you know, maybe not see them again for years or longer because they don't feel that it's safe enough to bring their child home? So, you know, the nun and the Scalabrinian organization, they were really surprised, frankly, by this robbery, thinking, you know, we're in a heavily Catholic country, maybe we'll have some degree of insulation. And so the fact that their property was breached and that she was robbed, I think, just really gives you a sense that nobody is safe, or as they put it, nobody is untouchable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're listing off this litany of a just impossible, an impossible situation, a devastating situation. And yet the conversation nationally around immigration, I mean, we're talking about it this week because Senate Republicans are trying to give ICE and CPB $72 billion, right? This is all the reason they're doing it now is because Democrats shut down DHS in a bid to get reforms to these agencies. And, you know, that effort was not successful. The Democrats don't have power. Republicans do. We are where we are. It's going to be passed through reconciliation in all likelihood. But it does bring to the fore the question of, like, how do we conduct some oversight over this? Republicans seem uninterested in the question of reform. Congressional Democrats have not been able to get into these facilities. You know, at the beginning of the podcast, we played some sound from Senator Andy Kim, who was trying to get into the Delaney Detention Center in New Jersey, the state he represents, and was pepper sprayed. I believe it was Maxine Dexter who went down to San Benito to try and get in touch with unaccompanied minors who were being housed there by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And that office basically scared the unaccompanied minors into not speaking with her. I mean, this is all happening in many cases, either in the sort of bowels of the bureaucracy of our immigration system or behind the four walls of a detention center. And I wonder, you know, how optimistic you are about the ability to, I mean, you're one of the few people that is firsthand reporting on this, but the national conversation has withered since the days of Alex Preddy and Renee Nicole Good's murder, because that was the murder of American citizens in plain sight.
That's right. And so it's really a question for me. You know, I don't know what it sort of takes to keep this issue on the public's radar when there are so many things, frankly, going on that feel urgent in the country right now. But I do think that there's a real strategy behind pulling back, a strategy on the White House's part, yeah, behind pulling back on the spectacle of ICE,
yeah,
you know, the horses, the, you know, violent clashes, although they haven't gone away entirely. Look at Delaney Hall, but the vastness of the violent clashes with protesters in the streets. There's a strategy there in, you can very much continue with the deportation campaign, a very effective one, you know, one that impacts hundreds of thousands of people a year. And you can do that pretty quietly. Mm-hmm. The tack that the Trump administration took right after taking office the second time was to make a splash and to really try to scare people into leaving and sort of brag about, you know, the delivering on these campaign promises that Trump had made. Obviously, that didn't sit well with the public, but that by no means indicates that deportations need to stop, that family separations need to stop. They can continue. And I think when it comes to Congress and the amount of leverage that Democrats do or don't have, you know, right after the election, Democrats really seem to be taking a moment to process that the country had voted in this president who, yeah, made a very clear promise of mass deportations. And so, you know, they were quieter when it came to supporting this originally $175 billion, essentially blank check that went to funding immigration enforcement with no oversight attached to it whatsoever, Alex. I mean, it was was a really stunning amount of money, but also just amount of freedom and carte blanche that was granted. And now, obviously, there has been enough public backlash that, you know, Democrats are trying to push to get into the nuance and the details. And there's a lot that Congress can do to limit deportations and limit kind of ICE activity, CBP activity, without eliminating by any means immigration enforcement writ large. You know, the Congress can set determinations for, you know, first of all, creating or protecting legal pathways that allow people to sort of make things right in the eyes of the law, to gain some sort of legal status that is has more protection than the ones that President Trump is sort of just dispensing with the signature. But then Congress can also set rules about, you know, ICE behavior, can create oversight offices, some of which Trump has really diminished and limited. You know, there are requirements that come with appropriations. That's typical. Congress hands out money, but it requires certain things of agencies in order for them to qualify for that money. And so that's where I think congressional Democrats could play a role in shifting what this deportation campaign looks like and who's impacted, and perhaps, you know, introducing protections for example, children who could be left without one or both parents.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the money that is at the root of, I mean, with money should come congressional oversight, right? Congress controls the purse and they could put protections in place. I am stunned to learn about what I see as clear-cut corruption at the top levels of ICE and immigration enforcement, the revolving door that exists between the private companies that run these detention facilities in specific, I'm talking about GEO Group, and the government officials who were once employed or will be employed by GEO Group, who then dole out millions of dollars to this group to help them run what, by all accounts, sound like terribly run facilities that are almost depraved in what they offer people who are being held there for months on end. Can you talk about the exchange, the cross-pollination between who's running ICE and who's running private security companies that are in charge with handling deportees?
Yeah, this is an issue that has existed almost since ICE's inception. There are a number of private prison companies that operate. The two biggest ones are GEO, as you mentioned, and CoreCivic. And you have regular movement between the highest echelons of DHS and its component agencies, including ICE, and the executive ranks of those private prison companies, who are then negotiating federal contracts to open and expand detention facilities for millions and millions, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And there's, you know, an incentive that you can just sort of imagine on the part of somebody who might want to, let's say, leave public service one day and work as a high-paid executive for a private company.
Who would that be, Caitlin? I can't imagine anybody in office. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. Or rather, there's a disincentive to, when it comes to, you know, holding these private companies to account and saying, wait, do we really need to be paying this much for this warehouse? Or, you know, what are you actually doing to make sure that detainees are safe, that health and safety standards are being maintained, that food is edible and available at all whatsoever? I want to say, you know, legally speaking, you described it as clear corruption. I mean, they're following the rules, right? The rules are set by Congress, and the rules that exist don't actually limit the existence of this revolving door. You know, I think the private prison companies are very clear, when I've reached out to them and reported on this many times, that they follow the reporting requirements that exist. That's another place where Congress could weigh in, but hasn't. And so the reality is that what they're doing is perfectly legal.
Yeah. Well, and here we are with detainees being, by all accounts, by some accounts, I shouldn't say, not all, inedible food that's covered in mold, dirty water, appalling facilities, denied medical care until it is life-threatening. I mean, at any rate. But to your point, this is all as it is, as the law suggests it must be. So until and unless something changes, GEO Group will continue to make exponentially large profits on a policy that is enacted by the Congress of the United States and signed off on by the President of the United States. I got one more question for you, Caitlin, because, you know, we're looking ahead to sort of what we can expect from ICE. And you make the really important point that ICE has changed its tactics publicly, but privately behind closed doors, it continues to be as dehumanizing and base as it has been since the Trump administration rode back into office. The World Cup is coming up. I'm excited about that as a soccer fan. I am not excited about the prospect of ICE conducting raids. I mean, Secretary of State Rubio has said that ICE is not going to operate inside of stadiums, but other Trump officials haven't ruled that out. Do you have a thought on the, like, first of all, do you have any intel on what the plan is for these mass sporting events that are going to bring together people from all backgrounds, all, I'm sure, immigration statuses, people from inside and outside the country for an event that's supposed to knit us together as a world community? Do you have any sense that ICE is planning anything in and around the World Cup? What's your expectation, I suppose, as we sort of try and calibrate our level of trepidation?
I wish I could say that I had a crystal ball or somebody who could tell me they knew exactly what was going to happen. I don't, you know, and I think the reality is that they might not know, because what we've seen repeatedly is that sometimes to sort of fearmonger is the plan itself, you know, to scare and intimidate people is the plan itself, and that ICE may have never actually intended to follow through. But it's also the case that sometimes a big enforcement initiative is planned. I remember reporting back in, I think it was 2018, on a plan to specifically go out into the country and target families and detain families in family detention. And the plan leaked and then ICE backed down because of the backlash that ensued. So I think that, you know, going after stadiums where cities do have lots of money on the line right now, you know, there's going to be a ton of eyes on these places, and local economies are really hoping to benefit from the World Cup. And you know, this is supposed to be a celebratory, fun thing for the world to, you know, pay attention to the United States during, and to turn that into a spectacle of immigration enforcement seems like it would carry significant political risk. But I also don't think you would ever be wise to rule something like that out, because obviously we've seen these calculations go both ways, and this administration absolutely pursue enforcement that was very politically risky, that did have backlash, and that they followed through with anyway. I think another risk around the World Cup that I want to raise that's concerning is that, you know, there are lots of examples that have cropped up of people posing as immigration officers and doing so to rob people, to manipulate them, to take advantage of them, either because they're trying to make money or just be cruel. And some of these cases have even been violent. And so, you know, one big question is, are ICE officers going to be present at stadiums? But another is, are there going to be random people who wear masks and pretend to be law enforcement officers and do that to take advantage of vulnerable people and put them in harm's way? Because that is also part of the fallout from the campaign that's underway right now.
Just terrorizing brown people, whether you have the license to do it or not, and giving a middle finger to the global community because make America great again. Okay, we are going to leave it on that depressing note. I still hold out hope that the World Cup can be a joyous event. Maybe watch it from home. Maybe don't go to a game. Caitlin Dickerson, you are a fount of information, and it is a real boon to have you here on Runaway Country. I'm so grateful for your time and obviously everything you do to report on one of the most underreported, traumatizing moments of our, you know, recent American history. So thank you, Caitlin, for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Alex. It's a really important conversation, so I'm glad that we could do it.
We try. That is our show for this week. Please don't forget to check out the show and our rapid response videos on our YouTube channel, Runaway Country with Alex Wagner. And if for some unknown reason you're not sick of me yet, please take a look at my Substack, How the Hell with Alex Wagner. Last but not least, if you've been impacted directly by the Trump administration or its policies, send us an email or a one-minute voice note at runawaycountry@crooked.com, and we may be in touch to feature your story. A sincere thank you to everyone who has written in already.
Mm-hmm.
Runaway Country is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Alona Minkowski, Emma Illich-Frank, Haley Jones, and Anisha Banerjee, with help from Eric Shoot, Kenny Moffitt, and Charlotte Landis. Production support from Ben Hethcote, Katie Long, Adrian Hill, and Matt DeGroat. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.